course, at the end of the Stanley Cup playoffs, like the focus, not just in this city, but in every NHL market, has shifted to the guys in suits, to the general managers. If I'm not mistaken, I think our marketing folks have got something called GM's Week, right? I've seen it advertised on TV, which I presume would be the draft and starting the free agent period and things of that nature, which is kind of cool, actually. Because that's kind of what happens at when the playoffs are over, right? Everybody immediately starts looking at the next season. In this city, we, as is often the case, seem to be looking forward to next season or talking about next season a little earlier than we'd like to. When it comes to the hockey team, that's certainly been the case this year. Such was the Leafs' exit from the playoffs and the aftertaste of that exit that it seems as if we've been in off-season mode with the Toronto Maple Leafs now for about a month. But obviously that will really pick up now that the playoffs are over, and we'll wait to see what the Seattle Kraken have planned for us in the expansion draft and, of course, NHL amateur draft and all that good stuff. And there really is a sense around the league that it is going to be a summer full of trade activity and as teams attempt to wrestle with the reality of the salary cap, but also I think attempt to figure out just how much a season and a half with no fans in the stands has damaged their bottom line. There are a lot of factors that are going to go into play here. I think the pandemic has probably changed timelines for a few teams. Let's be blunt, for some teams, it's been wasted contractual years. So there's all manner of things that'll be going on in the NHL in the offseason. But my friend Michael Grange wrote an article on Sportsnet.ca today that I think still remains to me the most fascinating story this offseason, with all due respect to the Toronto Maple Leafs. I'm not certain that, and I know Elliot Friedman has made the point that he thinks in some ways the Leafs are where the Raptors were when Masai Ujiri made that bold DeMar DeRozan trade to bring Kawhi Leonard in here. Elliot has said that it kind of feels to him as if the Leafs are at a point in time where they need to do something like that, something bold, something creative. And I was thinking about that reading Grange's piece today on Masai Ujiri. And you probably know by now that the NBA business year generally ends on June 30th. As Grange points out, pre-pandemic, Ujiri's status as the president of the Raptors, or not president of the Raptors, would have been sorted out and put to bed by now. But he's just assuming that because the NBA's business calendar has been pushed back by a month, the NBA draft is now July 29th, free agency opens August 2nd, it's just presumed that Ujiri's deal has simply rolled over. But Grange also points out that the people he's spoken to around the NBA have indicated that Masai Ujiri is acting, talking, and planning very much like a guy who plans on being here. Whether it's been at the NBA draft combine or during pre-draft workouts, the sense Grange is getting around the industry is that Masai has not checked out yet, I guess is the way to put it. And as I said, with all due respect to the Leafs, I think this is the most intriguing offseason story in Toronto sports, simply because It's not just a matter that in this city, as I've always said, I think we pay more attention to general managers than in a lot of other cities, general managers, presidents. But I just think there's, well, let's face it, he's the last guy to win a title here. And this is a team that's gone through a lot in the past couple of years. And he's a guy who really is, I mean, he's not just part of the Toronto sports scene. I would argue that Masai Ujiri has written himself large on the national sports and the national cultural scene. So it's understandable there'd be a lot of interest in where he's going and what he's going to do. This is one of the reasons I want to bring our next guest on, Doug Smith, the Raptors reporter for the Toronto Star, Raptors columnist, joining us on Writer's Block. Doug, thank you for doing this. I promise you we won't just talk about Masai, but you know, Grange's column today did get me thinking. And it's odd because I've got to admit that for the last couple of weeks, maybe the last 3 weeks, like I thought going into the offseason, Masai was going to be the story. Masai was going to be the story. I'd kind of forgotten that a little bit in these past 3 weeks. I'm just wondering how you feel about this. Like, beyond sort of the reporter's natural instinct to be curious about stuff, where do you think this situation sits right now?
I think it's exactly like Masai wants it. He doesn't want it a topical conversation. He hasn't since that night after the game at Game 6 at Oakland, when we started talking about it then. What was he going to do in 2 years? And would he get a new deal, a new extension, or a contract extension to 1 year left? And I think it's quite fine with him. I read Mike's piece today. It was very thorough, very good, and it's exactly the same thing everybody's hearing who talks to anyone. That Masai is operating as the president and general manager, president of basketball operations of the Raptors, and will be for the foreseeable future. I think we've all thought all along that he would be back. And he'll be back on his timeline. And I know Masai pretty well. He's the most competitive guy I know. Mm-hmm. So the chance to kind of rebuild the Raptors, I think it's a big deal to him. And he's also not a guy who really cares what people think. He'll go about it on his own time. And his own time will be get the draft over with, get free agency over with, get a 2-year deal or 3-year deal in place, and go from there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny hearing you say that, because I do think that sometimes we forget that there have been relationships between ownership and front office executives that have essentially existed on a handshake, right? Or maybe not a handshake, but an understanding that, look, I know what you want, you know what I want, just kind of get the work done. And at some point, there will be a time where we can actually put pen to paper. Like, Beeston used to work that way all the time. He just did. We'll take care of it. And if we can't, well, then we'll figure out how we are going to make it amicable.
Exactly.
Very straightforward.
I think Masai and Larry Tannenbaum have a great relationship. And I do think Masai wants to get some kind of commitment from the group of owners that they will allow him to spend what he needs to spend to win a championship. There's been nothing in the history of the Raptors to suggest that won't happen. So I really do think it's a matter of, okay, let's get our stuff taken care of. Then we'll sit down and we'll go through the clause by clause, line by line of a contract, and then we'll get it done. Or we won't get it done and I'll move on. But I think getting it done is far, far, far more likely.
Let's shift focus then to the NBA finals. Phoenix Suns leading 2-0. Devin Booker and Chris Paul, I think we all thought going into this series, were going to be the story for the Phoenix Suns. I think very early, you know, Doug, I was looking at it from the Milwaukee Bucks, and of course, you always think about the Bucks, you think of Giannis, but I think about 10 minutes into the game, I started buying into the whole idea that, you know what, it's going to be Jrue Holiday that is going to have to be. I don't know if he's going to be better than Giannis, but Jrue Holiday has to be no worse than the second best Milwaukee Buck for this team to win. Have you seen anything through the first two games to suggest otherwise?
No, and I also will suggest he cannot be that guy. He's a good player, but I think that and I thought this from the very start, the Suns' guard depth with Booker and Paul and Cam Johnson and Campaign and it's just kind of unrelenting and overwhelming. And the Bucks don't have that. And they have Giannis, who is a seminal talent, no question. But he had 42 and 12 last night.
Mm-hmm.
And they at no point from the middle of the second quarter on did you think they could win. Because the Suns are just better and deeper at far more positions. And I get that, you know, Middleton had an off night, but, you know, Chris Middleton has a lot of off nights. I think he has more average nights than all-star nights.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you can count on him. Holiday, you know, he guarded his butt off last night and got shredded.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't able to keep up with Paul or Booker. So I think the Bucks can climb back into it, but I doubt they can make it a real series. I think it's a gentleman's sweep. I think you're looking at five.
Yeah, and the other thing too with Jrue Holiday is you're right. I mean, I think he's trying as best he can, and he is guarding his ass off. And I think he's expending so much energy that it's affecting his offensive game as well. And that's to be expected.
Yeah, like last night in the first half, people were lauding him for his defense, absolutely justifiably, but he was like 4 for 12,
yep.
And you can't have that. And he has to give them more on the offensive end. Middleton had a bad night, but again, I don't even think he would. Middleton playing as well as he can. The Bucks have enough overall depth. Like, who guards Michael Bridges? And I know I know in Toronto that we love PJ Tucker, but in two games, have you heard his name? I haven't.
No, he has not. He has not been a factor. In point of fact, it's been the Suns' role players that have kind of, I don't know if I'd say emerged in this series, because guys like, you know what Jay Crowder is, but it just seems as if Monty Williams, it's almost as if it's the perfect team for him to coach. And maybe a large part of that, Mitch Lawrence said, well, a large part of that comes from having Chris Paul. Chris Paul's will help any coach be a better coach. But this just seems to be such a smooth functioning team.
They're unrelenting, and they can win a game a lot of different ways, and they do not panic or turn the ball over. Like, they don't make mistakes, which I think is the most impressive thing in this entire playoff run, is that they don't kick the ball all over the gym, and they don't let teams get big runs on them. And that's a testament, I think, to coaching and being able to calm players down at the right time and having smart players who know, okay, we'll weather this storm, we're going to be fine. And they just play with a sense of calm that I think is very, very impressive.
You mentioned Michael Bridges. He's been a bit of a revelation for this team this year, hasn't he?
Oh, I love him. I had him on my third team all NBA. Second team all defense. I think he's a great defensive player. I think he's a multifaceted, can guard a lot of guys in a lot of different positions, and he can make a corner three, which in the Phoenix system is the biggest asset you've got. Him, Crowder, they can make that shot, and that's what Phoenix is needing, and it's what they're getting.
As we get close to the NBA draft, or closer to the NBA draft, we're not certainly there yet. Any indication you're getting that the Raptors are going to do anything other than use that draft pick? Is there any more possibilities or anything you're hearing out, trading out or putting any other packages together?
No, nothing right now. But Jeff, you know, being around drafts for 100 years, everybody at this time of year is lying to you. No one is telling you the truth.
Right.
Players, agents, general managers, presidents, other reporters, no one knows. But right now, I don't think there's any indication, and I don't think there's any reason that the Raptors wouldn't take whoever is there at four of the top four.
Smitty, we're going to let you scoot. Appreciate you doing this as always. Stay safe,
man. All right, doctor. All right, doctor. Anytime.
Take care. That's Doug Smith, Raptors reporter with the Toronto Star. I'm sure he's out enjoying a patio. I don't know. Maybe it's raining. Maybe he won't be out enjoying a patio. It certainly sounds like he's out and about. We appreciate Smitty joining us. Yeah, I think I would urge you to read Grange's article. And I think Doug's right. And I know Doug's kind of taken a very measured approach to this all along. And I think I've always kind of felt with Masai, I think Doug kind of hit the nail on the head. it's not that his personal status, contractual status, or situation isn't important to him. I don't think he necessarily cares whether or not it's important to other people beyond the people who need to know. Obviously, his family, obviously Larry Tannenbaum, the board, Nick Nurse, Bobby Webster. I'm sure there are some players who've talked to him who have an understanding. I think beyond that circle, Masai really doesn't have a lot of time or doesn't have an inclination to worry about how he is being perceived. As long as the people who need to know what he's doing or are comfortable having a read on what he's doing, he really doesn't care whether the media, fans, talk show hosts, I don't think he cares what folks think about the situation. That's kind of the way he does. It's kind of the way Masai does business. You know, I like to think, though, that Masai realizes that the reason his contract is a talking point or an object of reflection for fans is because he has a great deal of currency, not just with the Toronto Raptors fan base, but he, I think, has become, as I said earlier, he's a figure who kind of transcends simply the Raptors or even the Canadian basketball fraternity. He's become very much a national, I wouldn't call him an icon. And for some people, he's an icon, but he's become a national figure. You keep thinking back to how he visited Africa to help push Canada's case to get a seat in the UN Security Council. He was one of the folks that went over to help push Canada's case. Ultimately, of course, Canada didn't get a seat in the Security Council. But think about that. That is a reflection of the currency he has. That is a reflection of how important a figure he is. So I think that explains the interest in Masai, let alone that he's brought the city a championship. I think he is frankly one of the most interesting national figures out there. His currency with a lot of people. His voice is heard in a lot of different corridors. His causes have taken him into a lot of different corridors. And as a result, it's odd, but I think that desire to want to know what he's doing is also kind of assuaged a bit by the degree of trust people have in him. So, yeah, it would be great. I mean, I hope at some point we find out that a deal's been done. I think Smitty's right. A lot of people look at how he's operating, what he's said, certainly within the industry, the people who've spoken to him, they are under the impression that he is very much invested in getting this thing back on board. And, as Doug said, at some point, maybe once the draft is done, maybe once the heavy lifting is done, he'll get a chance to sit back and say, okay, now let's put pen to paper and get this thing finalized. But terrific insight from Doug Smith, as always. Orestes Destrada is a former MLB infielder. He's currently Rays studio analyst for Bally Sports Sun. The Jays and Rays open a 3-game series tonight at the Trop. 7 o'clock is the first pitch right here on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, the Rays in second place, ahead of the Blue Jays, just behind the Red Sox. Their manager, Kevin Cash, has already come out and said, this is the biggest series of the year for us. We'll talk to Orestes Destrada about that. This is Writer's Block for Friday on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. bit of time last week figuring out how to describe the Toronto Blue Jays' first half of the season for an article on sportsnet.ca, and talk about it as well in the air, obviously. It's been kind of a weird first half for this team. Well, I mean, I guess that stands to reason considering their home games have been played in Buffalo and Dunedin, but even beyond that, it's been exciting. It's been exhilarating. The offensive performances of Bo Bichette, Vladdy Jr., and to a certain degree, Marcus Semien, certainly in the case of Vladdy and Bo, are, it's like every day you get another release from the Blue Jays or another note on the Blue Jays official Twitter account that Bo Bichette is, now tied with this player for however many runs, home runs, stolen bases in this game. Today, I believe, was the most home runs, doubles, steals through 159 games, tying with Nomar Garciaparra or something. I mean, this is what we're talking about. Every day something happens. There's some sort of statistical thing recorded by these two players that you look at it and you go, wow, that's pretty cool to be included in a list of players that include those other names. So there's been a lot of excitement around this team. But it's also been, I think, kind of disappointing in that here we are on July 9th, and the Blue Jays are 8 back in the East, 3.5 back in the wild card, which, is certainly not something you're going to overcome. But I think folks here look around the American League East, they look at the troubles the Yankees are going through. They look at the injuries the Rays have had, and they look at the Boston Red Sox. And with all due respect to the Boston Red Sox, I'm willing to bet that there is a large segment of the Blue Jays fan base that is sitting there saying, you know what? If we're chasing the Red Sox, if the Red Sox are the team setting the pace in first place, we still got a chance. I think there's still a feeling that people are underselling the Red Sox. And I raise my hand because I've kind of done it all year as well. So I'm wondering, that's the Toronto point of view. I'm wondering how Tampa views their first half and how they view this three-game series against the Jays that will start tonight. Orestes Destrada is a Rays TV analyst for Bally Sports Sun, and he joins us on Writer's Block. Orestes, thank you so much for joining us today. We trust that you're keeping well. How do you think the Rays would describe the first half of this season?
Well, thanks for having me on, Jeff. And it was a very kind of cool to hear your thoughts on the Blue Jays, which I thought they had a solid first half, 4 games over 500, all the offense, surprising, very good pitching. We're concerned about them. As far as us, similar to last year, probably more so like the year before in 19. We're mired in a slew of pitching injuries, so we've had to overcome that, and this team is incredibly resilient, if you haven't noticed, and I know you do, Jeff, in how they can next man up, how their swarm attack is, especially, with the arms. They just have an incredible propensity to be able to not only develop, but find new talent, scouting-wise, cross-checking-wise, bring them in, get them with their mantra, and then squeeze the best out of them. You can already think this year, guys like Springer, they're throwing out JP Fire Rising. I wouldn't throw Drew in there, Rasmussen, because I think he was an expected arm to, be wanted from the Milwaukee Brewers chain, a young guy. But they're able to do that and kind of recreate Rich Hill. It's another one, obviously Colin McHugh, my gosh, I mean, honestly should be in the All-Star game with what he's dramatically done since May 4th. Offensively, we've been sporadic. We have been hot and cold, and I mean super hot in May, super cold in June. So this has been a team that's trying to find itself wrist-wise, runner scoring position, and it's been this ebb and flow with that. But in the meantime, super steady pitching, super steady defense, super steady, you know, team WA. You know, I played in Japan, and WA is unity, and they are very, very good about that.
Kevin Cash was apparently, I guess he was on the MLB Network earlier today, and he made the point that he thought, and he had sort of suggested that he was going to tell his team somehow that this is a big series for them.
Yes.
I know, you know, John Schneider, the Blue Jays coach, told us on Baseball Central that, you know, said we didn't have a team meeting about it, but, you know, Charlie had a couple of words for the guys last night. He said kind of a couple of nice words for the guys last night. He said, you know, yeah, there's a realization. This is a big series for the Jays. Two of three or a sweep will certainly leave them feeling a whole heck of a lot better going into the break. Similar for the Rays, I would think. Like, I know Kevin is like a lot of baseball people, right? Arrestus, nobody really likes to come out and say this is the biggest series of the year or this is a big series, because your first reaction is, come on, it's July 9th. A whole bunch of stuff can happen. But you do get the sense that both teams feel this is a series they want to win.
I think because of how close we play, you got to understand that the series, the people that really, like you and I, the coaches, the managers, the players, the diehard fans that have studied the 40 last games between the Rays and the Jays have been so close. Have got to go either way. A lot of slugging, a lot of this and that, but it's always 6-5, 7-6, 5-4. I mean, it's incredible. And 70% of the time, the Rays have been on top with that. So, you know, you could say bullpen, no doubt. We head and shoulders, you know, trump you guys in bullpen, though you guys are having, you know, I think a solid bullpen year. And that's a big thing. So when you get towards the end of the game, we get clutch hits, you know, we get clutch closeouts. But other than that, they've been so close that I think Charlie Montoyo is going, like, if we can take two out of three, you know, sweep, the momentum that you're going into in the playoff in the second half now, the true second half, because we're already past second half, obviously, is dramatic. And conversely, our guys and Cash feels the exact the same way. So there's no reason to think that if we can, you know, distance ourselves from Toronto with this series, then when we come back next Friday, our sights are set on the Bo Sox. And, you know, everybody else are playing, of course, but we kind of start distancing ourselves from some other teams.
Yeah, this is going to be a great pitching matchup tonight because Alek Manoah, of course, was the guy on the mound when the Jays won 11-1. And Shane McClanahan is you know, his third time against the Jays. And he's a lefty who throws 100. But it's interesting because this is for both of these guys, this is going to be the second time they faced this team in a week. Manoah's start, of course, is rained out, so now he's going back-to-back against the Rays. McClanahan going back-to-back against the Jays. Are either of these guys going to change anything? Or is this just simply a matter of the hitters will have to adjust and then the pitchers will adjust off the hitters?
Tonight's game, I'm going to be honest with you, and people should definitely watch it because it's going to feature two of the best young sliders from either side of the plate that you're going to see in a Major League Baseball game tonight on Friday, July 9th. I mean, dramatic. The kid Manoah slider is devastating, right? And our guy throwing, you know, 98 to 100 with his fastball, and he's really starting to become more aggressive, Sugar Shane McClanahan. Now he's going into zone, not being afraid. Not that he was afraid before, he was just nibbling. Now he's going at you, and then he drops this yellow hammer slider, this back leg slider that is just devastating. So you're going to see no change from them, aggressiveness from these two big boys, and it should be fun to watch. Now we're going to see which hitters came most prepared, most studied, you know, and deal with this because that's going to be who comes out, you know, who can knock out these guys, get to the pen, and play some really good defense. By the way, lastly, I'll say one of the big, you know, like monkey on Toronto's back over those 30, 40 games I'm talking about has been their defense. So it seems that somewhere along the line in these games, in the 70% that the Rays have won, I'd say half of those, there's been a defensive mistake or two or three that have given the Rays one, two, three, you know, runs, and then they've closed the door. So it'll be interesting how they play behind Shane, behind the kid Manoah, and then he who plays better defense will probably come out on top, because I'm expecting another tight game. The rest of the series for you guys with Stripling, I was very impressed with him. I'm not as high on him, you know, as a stud against us. He just, you know, he's thrown well against us. I think we'll figure him out. That'll be an interesting start for him. And then you got Matt, I believe, coming off the DL or the
it's
IL.
Actually Ray. And Ray is the pitching list they've given out. We were operating under the same assumption it was Matt's. It's actually apparently Robbie Ray, according to the Jays now.
No, you know why? And that's a smart one. If Ray can pitch, I think you give not only Matt the break, a little longer break. Maybe you send him and get him a little simulated game so he's ready to go, you know, the following Friday. But he's just coming off an IL. Matt's is very – I mean, not Matt's. Ray is very difficult on us. Yeah. And his, you know, way he works quick and throws those fastballs in all those different quadrants and has such great control with it that he gives us fits, though, you know, we got to him a little bit the last time. But I think it's a great series set up for you guys with those three, and we're going to have to show up.
Last question for you before we let you run, Arrestus. What do we need to know about Vidal Bruján? We're led to believe that he will be up. And Yeah, it's like every time the Jays face the Rays, I was talking to somebody in their front office about this. He said, you either get another prospect or you get an arm, right. And you just look at it and go, now, where the hell did that come from?
Where did Fire Rice, you know, where the hell did this guy come from?
Exactly.
Saving games. And I agree with you 100%. I'm going to tell you something right now about Vidal Bruján. Watch out. This is the best way I can describe him, and you're not going to like it, Jeff. You're not going to like it because you didn't get the best of him. You might have gotten the best of him for a little bit. He's Jose Reyes in his prime as a young Met. That's what this guy is. He's potentially Jose Reyes, electric, wiry, beefed up a little bit because a lot of these guys that didn't play last year that were top prospects, obviously, you know, the good thing about for them not having games, you know, when you lift during the regular season, just this little tidbit for the fans, everything. When you're lifting during the regular season, you're not really building bulk. You're just trying to sustain. And you normally lift after games, believe it or not. A lot of players will go and lift after games to just kind of get a little bit of something. Then you come in the next day, and, you know, it's 100 and something games that each player is playing, right? Well, when you're off like that and all you're doing is practicing, you really can bulk up. So he's bulked up. You know, some of these other guys are truly bulked up nice. They're at the proper age at 22, 23. Obviously, our boy Wander Franco is 20. That he's really, you know, it's really taken. And he is just electric. The fastest player, and we have some really fast players. Kevin Kiermaier, you know, MLB class top speed. Arozarena maybe even be a little faster than Kiermaier. Wander comes in, Vidal comes in that roster. And he blows both of them away. That's how fast he is. So I'm excited. The reason I'm so excited is because I interviewed him in Spanish about 3 years ago. No, it was actually about 4 years ago. So he was 19, 20 years old. And I just got such exuberance, such excitement from the kid. Then I followed him through his minor league years. So I'm going to say even more so than Wander, having gotten to know him. I'm so excited about this kid. You're going to enjoy watching him play, and hopefully – you know, they'll play like Reyes of the Mets and not Reyes of the Blue Jays. Oops.
Yeah. Arrestus, thanks so much for doing this, man. Great to talk to you as always. Stay safe.
You got it, my man. Peace.
Take care. That's Arrestus Destrada, Rays analyst on Valley Sun Sports. It gets 7 o'clock tonight, first pitch, first of three. Jays and Rays, Shane McClanahan. Sugar Shane McClanahan. I love the name. Sugar Shane McClanahan against Alek Manoah. We don't have a nickname for Alek Manoah yet. First pitch at 7 o'clock. Alan Smith appeared in 464 Premier League matches, scored 162 goals, appeared in 13 matches for England internationally with a couple of goals. If you've heard of Gary Lineker, the much touted, much talked about BBC analyst, Alan Smith played alongside Gary Lineker at Leicester City in his first season, scoring 13 goals alongside Gary Lineker, the Leicester City Foxes. Alan Smith is now with Sky Sports. We're going to talk a little Euro with him. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, welcome back to Writer's Block. We will be joined by Toronto FC President Bill Manning at 4 o'clock, Canadian IOC delegate. Dick Pound will be along at 4:20. The IOC, of course, announcing that the Olympics will be held at least in Tokyo, the Tokyo prefecture, without fans in attendance. I have no idea whether or not that's a result of COVID-19. State of emergency. I have no idea if that will also apply to other parts of Japan where various events will be held. But it's already Nick Kyriakos of Australia has already said that he will not be going to the Olympics because of the fact that there are no fans in the stands. So I mean, other athletes I think have already made their commitments, but. It's certainly, I can't say it's a surprise if you've been following the course of COVID-19 in Japan, but sort of hearing it officially, I think, was a real cupful of cold water for a lot of sports fans who were at least anticipating the possibility of having some fans at the Olympics. So we'll be joined by Dick Pound to talk about that. No concern. With fans on Sunday at Wembley as Italy will take on England in the final of Euro 2020. I think it's safe to say, we had Martin Tyler on yesterday, these are the two best teams in the tournament. They're certainly the two teams that have played the best together as teams. I guess the question for England is you look at Italy, they haven't been... They've been behind 10 minutes in their last 24 matches. They're unbeaten in 33 going back to September 2018. You know, some countries fail to make the World Cup and they kind of go into hibernation. The Italians failed to make the World Cup in Russia and they've come out with, they've come out focused. And it'll be a fascinating match on Sunday. We're very pleased to be joined by Alan Smith, former Premier League striker, current 2020 color analyst for UEFA's World Feed, Sky Sports analyst. He's also a columnist for the London Evening Standard. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today. We trust that you're keeping well. You know, look, as someone who follows the Prem and is a footy fan and has been fully invested in this this competition, I was thinking about this today, and I've got to say, first of all, it's great to see fans back in the stands coming out of COVID-19, but I've really been surprised by the caliber of play in this competition in general. Do you see it the same way? I know there have been a lot of own goals, but I think the caliber of play has really superseded what I thought it would be.
Yeah. Well, hi, Jeff. First of all, nice to talk to you. Yeah, I think we've all enjoyed the tournament. Probably we weren't quite sure how it was going to pan out after the season we've had across Europe, really. To looking at the Premier League, it's been an up and down one. Lots of injuries. You know, obviously they didn't have the pre-season as they would do normally, the length of it prior to this last campaign. And no fans as well has led to some strange results, some strange performances from teams and individuals. But it does seem like back to normal with the fans and supporters affect players. You know, you can't underestimate how much they do for better or for worse at times. But it's led to a fantastically entertaining tournament. I've loved every second of it. We've had some shocks, haven't we, with the big guns going out. Which is always a great thing because you just never know in football. You just never know, and we don't know what's going to happen Sunday either.
What do you think Sunday's match Like, what will I'm not going to ask you what the key matchup will be, because I don't think it's going to be decided by one person. It may be decided on one side of the pitch. I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on England's wing play. But I'm just wondering what you think this may come down to.
I think perhaps who handles the situation better, the occasion better. We've got two very talented teams, talented starting 11s, and also lots of quality on the benches, which, as we know, that can decide games, and it has done a few times in this tournament. I think England have probably got even more quality than Italy coming off the bench. But they're two well-matched sides. I've done a lot of Italy's games, commentated on them, and they've been entertaining, always entertaining, not the archetypal Italian side sitting back, the Catenaccio, and trying to hit you on the break, just trying to smother the life out of you. They've been on the front foot. Insigne's been wonderful. Obviously, Chiesa's come into it. Berardi, the lads in the wide positions. Spinazzola, the left back, I think he was my player of the tournament up until the point that he got injured. So that's a big blow for Italy, because that takes away a lot of their forward thrust on that left-hand side. But, two well-matched teams. There's not much to separate them. So really looking forward to it.
You know, you wrote an interesting commentary for Sky Sports on Gareth Southgate. And, you know, we've obviously, it's, again, for people who follow the Premier League and sort of pay attention to the English team, even if it's not, you know, your national team, it's been interesting watching how he has been, watching how his reputation has grown throughout his tenure as England manager. And you made a terrific point, and I saw him do this during the match, and I wasn't entirely certain for the tactical reasons, but your point, when he substituted Jack Grealish after bringing him into the game as a sub, you know, never mind the fact that Jack Grealish is the fans' favorite, but it showed kind of a clinical, I don't know if you'd say cold-heartedness, but it certainly showed a clinical side to Gareth Southgate that I don't know if you would have seen from him 4 years ago, for example.
Well, yeah, it's a good point. And he's developing, he's maturing as a manager. He's got good experience at tournament level now, having started with the under-21s and then, you know, the World Cup in 2018 and now, because it's a special skill, I think, handling a squad over the course of a tournament, 4 weeks or whatever. But I think he's got that confidence now to make those kind of decisions, and that does come with maturity. As you say, Jack, he's the fans' favourite. Everybody wants to see him on that pitch. But the situation, he thought, demanded something different. Kieran Trippier going on, extra defender, to see out that result. And he would have had a quiet word with Jack Grealish, no doubt, in the dressing room afterwards, just to explain his actions. And I would imagine Jack took that on board. If he doesn't, you know, more for him, really, but I'm sure he does, because he's loving every minute of this tournament, Grealish, and he's just enjoying being a part of it. But for Southgate, he'll make those hard decisions. He's never been swayed by media opinion, you know, the noise from outside the camp as to who should play. He's his own man. He knows exactly what he wants, and he's stuck with that. And I think all top managers have to have that courage of their convictions.
Alan, how much of this do you think is helped by the fact that this seems to be a more unified group than some previous, you know, incarnations of the English team? Like, you don't seem to have that sort of that Manchester United clique. That may say more about where Manchester United is, but you don't have that sort of club clique, you know, and the guys eating at the dining room table by themselves because the guys from other teams don't necessarily want to associate with them. Is that very much a part of this, do you think?
Yeah, it looks a really tight-knit group. Everybody gets on really well. But I was talking to a friend about this today, you know, and I think it's maybe a reflection of how football has changed in general now, because you'll see teams lining up in a tunnel and they're all having a little laugh and a joke between the two sides, a bit of backslapping, whereas perhaps 10, 15, 20 years ago, it will be steely glares ahead, no fraternising with the enemy. You'll shake hands after the game, but certainly not the kind of friendliness you see now across the two camps. And perhaps that's helped England in that they all look very good mates. There aren't those divisions, those club rivalries when they get together. And Italy have got a great team spirit. We've seen that time and again, you know, just before extra time, Mancini and his players, and at the end of games, the way they've celebrated together. England are the same, and you've got to have that to be a successful side.
Alan, really good of you to join us today. This has been a real treat. Thanks so much.
No, all the best, Jeff. Take care.
Be well. Yep, that's Alan Smith, Sky Sports analyst. He is a current Euro 2020 color analyst for UEFA's World Feed. Sunday will be Italy against England. And a little bit of soccer news for you as well here. Not great news if you're a fan of the Canadian national team. But Alphonso Davies will miss the CONCACAF Gold Cup after suffering an ankle injury during training earlier this week. So there's still a lot of depth in that Canadian team. You know, there are other competitions, frankly, that supersede the Gold Cup as far as Canada is concerned when it comes to qualifying for the World Cup. But certainly, given the fact that Jonathan David has been hampered at times by injuries as well, it's going to test some of that much ballyhooed offensive depth that we've talked about the Canadian team possessing now that it hasn't had in the past. So again, Alphonso Davies will miss the CONCACAF Gold Cup after suffering an ankle injury during training earlier this week. Bill Manning is president of the Toronto Argonauts and Toronto FC. Been a difficult stretch for Toronto FC. Bill Manning joins us. Dick Pound as well. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Well, we now know that the Tokyo Olympics will at least begin in Tokyo without fans in the stands. That's been made official. As I said, I'm not certain it was came as an earth-shattering development. I'm sure a lot of Olympic athletes kind of thought in their heart of hearts. They were hoping, obviously, that there would be fans in the stands. But I think certainly a realization that given the path, the slow path of recovery in Japan, insofar as COVID-19 is concerned, I think most Olympic athletes probably going over to Tokyo deep down thought that the best case scenario would be some fans in the stands. As we said, that is not the case, at least in Tokyo. Some of the satellite events, we're led to believe, may have a limited number of fans in attendance. We'll get a better idea of that, certainly, as the Olympics get closer. And we'll also maybe get more insight in that from Dick Pound, the bottom of the hour, as he joins us ahead of the Olympics, ahead of the preparations for the Tokyo Games. We now know that Ontario will move to stage 3 of its opening plan, its reopening plan, on July 16th. That was reported earlier this morning. That is, I believe, I want to say 5 days earlier than originally planned, which is certainly good news for a lot of us who've been doing what we can do to adhere to best practices and but at the same time have been, I think it's safe to say, itching a little bit to get as close as we possibly can to normalcy in all aspects of our life. That, by the way, just happens to be one day before Toronto FC's next scheduled match. So, inquiring minds want to know whether or not that match will be played here in Toronto. And I guess to a certain degree whether there would be any fans in the stands at that match. Bill Manning is president of Toronto FC and the Toronto Argonauts, and he joins us on Writer's Block. Bill, thank you for doing this. I trust that you're keeping well. We have a ton to talk about, but I just wanted to get to that initially. What is your level of confidence that we may be able to see TFC playing here on July 16th?
Yeah, I'm July 17th. So July 17th.
Pardon me, 17th.
Yeah,
yes.
We feel really good about it. We had a phone call this morning with the league. The league continues to work with you know, the protocols that are in place for teams to cross the border, and obviously we're in touch with all the local officials, and so I think over the weekend, I'm thinking everything is going to check off, and hopefully on Monday we'll get final answers and good news. That's but I do feel pretty good about it based on all the conversations and the regulations now that are in place that allow us to do a lot of what we need to do to put the game on.
Bill, how much cooperation has there been between sports teams in Toronto when it comes to this? And I'll focus on sort of the MLSE teams in general. But like, I've always felt that it's like anything else. It's sort of success is built off other people's success, right? In other words, if one sports organization shows that it can pull it off, and there's no side effects to the wider public health situation, that makes it easier for the next, and that makes it easier for the next as well. Has there been any a level of cooperation at the president's level between, you know, maybe yourself and the Leafs and I don't know, the Jays and the Raptors?
Well, certainly, within our family, Brendan and Masai are friends and confidants, and we talk and we support each other. In fact, both of them, reached out to me actually this past week, just to kind of say, hang in there, man, mm-hmm. It's get through this rough start, and we're there for you, and it just meant so much to me. And I know the Raptors had a tough year in Tampa, and Masai and I have talked about that being relocated, and we have a lot of synergy between the three teams and certainly with the Argonauts coming back as well, and how they've been able to pull everything together. They start tomorrow in Guelph. And then Mark and I have spoken, a few times over this break, and what they're looking to do and what we're looking to do. You know, their situation's a little bit different because they have the 3-game homestand, whereas for us it's basically an in and out. It's a 1-game. But we all work very cooperatively. We have all three of us have very good relationships with Mark and support the Blue Jays, and within MLSE, I know just between Brendan, Masai, and myself, we have really good relationships with each other, and we support each other. And so, the teams are together, and we have a rock star by the name of Jennifer Sullivan who handles all of this for us, and the security and all the relations with the government, her and Nick Eves, and they've done a great job. So I'm really positive. And I think the government officials, I think they've been diligent, but they've also been very receptive in working with us. And we understand their position, and they have tried to find solutions. And I'm hoping that, us and the Jays will both be back very soon.
The one issue that seems to be the outstanding issue, and I understand it's not entirely within your the realm of your control, just as it isn't in Mark's or anybody else's, but or any other team executive in any sport. But the idea that there are going to be players, there are going to be people in organizations who aren't going to be vaccinated. I think Nick DeLeon has talked about that. We know, the Blue Jays, I don't believe, have 100% of their players vaccinated. I could be wrong. I know they've reached the 85% threshold that Major League Baseball required of teams in order to, relax protocols. But I also know there are some teams that aren't anywhere near 85%. And I'm wondering how this, the issue of non vaccinated players factors in here? Because obviously we're dealing with, you know, we're dealing with public health issues, but we're also dealing with an individual's right to make a decision.
Yep.
Has that, you know, has there been any pushback from governments about that? Or how, and I, again, I understand, as you said, the teams coming into Toronto are going to be in and out. The Jays opponents are going to be here for 3 days. But you might have a player who's going to be playing every day for you who lives in Toronto who isn't vaccinated. Has there been any pushback?
Yeah. Well, you know, it is. It's the reality. And what we're doing is everything that we're doing is within the current guidelines and the regulations. And so, you know, we have two players who are not fully vaccinated that have to quarantine now for 14 days. And it's just... These are the rules and decisions were made and we're supportive of the players to make their own decisions. But we obviously have to continue training and move forward with games. And so we're, you know, the thing that we're really focusing on is let's play within the rules. You know, any exemptions the government gives us will be welcome. And outside of that, you know, we're just going to play under the current regulations and what we can do at the moment. And those that are not vaccinated, if they can't cross the border or whatever it is, they can't train now for 14 days. That is the reality, and we're just going to have to work around that.
All right, I do want to get to the Argonauts in a minute because, as you mentioned, they are opening training camp in Guelph, and finally, we're going to see CFL football. Which, you know, someone who lives in Hamilton, I'm sorry to say that, Bill, but as someone who lives in Hamilton, I'm looking forward to being able to get out to Tim Hortons Field.
We play them four times this year. They're tough. They're a good team.
Well, I tend to be very low key when I go to games, so I put sunglasses and a hat on and just sort of hide behind people. But I'm looking forward to seeing them back in the field. I wanted to ask you about the Toronto FC on the pitch and the start this team had. Clearly, nobody foresaw this. Where did it go wrong with Chris Armas?
You know, it was it's a few issues, I think, that worked against Chris and the team really clicking. You know, early on, we had, you know, two particular players. You know, Alejandro Pozuelo, last year's MVP, arguably our best player, was out. He was injured earlier this year, and so he is a difference maker on the field for us. And Jonathan Osorio missed a number of games early on. You know, and then our new player Jefferson Soteldo came in and pulled up with a little injury, and he's back now. You saw a difference he made the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we were shortchanged a little bit. Chris was shortchanged a little bit with some of our best players. You know, obviously we had a bit of a fractured relationship there with he and Josie, which, you know, Josie's been a big player here, and that, you know, I think had an effect as well. You know, the relocation to Florida, not ideal, right? It would just,
yep.
You, those of us who were there, and certainly Raptors, you know, experienced the same thing. It's just, it's tough. It's not the same as being home, and being able to play in front of your fans and go home that evening. And then I think, you know, there was a transition to a new playing style, and, you know, with all that combined with trying to play a different style and get everyone in line with that, it just wasn't clicking. And, you know, I thought, you know, when we came back for 3 weeks, then we had three games in 7 days when we went back to Florida, that we would be able to punch our way out of it. And we gave up two very early goals against Orlando, came back, you know, Alejandro was in the game, and we scored a couple of goals, but then we conceded in the 84th minute or so, and we go on to lose all three games. Orlando goes to win all three games that week. And then, you know, we go into D.C. and we get shellacked. And it just, for me, I could tell that the team was not going to rebound with Chris in that role. And so, obviously we made the decision, and we're going to move forward from here.
Was it harder to move on from Greg Vanney than you originally anticipated? Now, let me rephrase that. Did looking back, understanding hindsight is what it is. Was it maybe too much of a reach bringing in somebody who was going to have a new philosophy, a new style of play?
Yeah, look, I think you learn in all these situations, and I like to say I try to learn every single day. One of the strategies was to try not to shake up the roster too much in bringing in a new coaching staff. And I think, certainly some of the injuries to the key players hurt early on, hurt Chris. Under different circumstances, maybe it could have worked with the style that he wanted to play. But, even just the other night, Javier Perez came in and he got us back to our basics, which was keep the ball, keep some possession. We had our best players on the field with Pozuelo and Soteldo, and we played a very compact defensive game. And, we came away with a win. And I think his, the thought was, let's put our players in the best positions for them to succeed. And I think, that wasn't happening under Chris. And so, in hindsight, you look at it, yeah, I think you learn from it, Jeff. I don't want to shy away from that. You learn from it, and I like to say, you don't want to be changing coaches all the time either. But under a scenario like that, where there's a kind of a philosophy built, it's certainly a learning process for the future.
Will Javier Perez be the he is the interim coach right now? Will he be in charge on the 17th?
So we're gonna continue with Javier and in the interim and just see how things play out. And my hope was that we would get a reaction from the team, which I think we did. We now have 22 games left, 13 at BMO Field, hopefully all of them at BMO Field, five of the next seven at home. And so I think this is a really key stretch for us. And if we could just, win our home games and take, one game at a time here and just kind of claw our way back up. Hopefully we're back in the mix, come towards the end of the season, we can get ourselves a playoff spot. And if we're playing really good soccer, once you get in the playoffs, you can go and you can win this thing. So that's our focus right now is let's see how it plays out and, getting our best players back on the field and being back at home in front of our fans. I mean, even in New England this past week, we had a 3-0 lead and they chipped away 3-1, 3-2, and you could just feel the energy in that stadium from their fans. And our guys did something that has been symbolic of TFC over the last few years is we bent, but we didn't break. And that was a really good sign for me that we walked away, because I feel like 2 weeks ago, we lose that game. We find a way to lose that game. And so we won, and that was a good sign for us. But boy, the fans, they make a difference. And certainly at BMO Field, Jeff, I'm sure you've seen one of our games. Our fans are fantastic, and that's a big help for us, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, it's obviously the atmosphere there is something special. Given everything that's gone on, what are your expectations for the Argos this year, Bill? And I'm thinking in particular, this is a league that, didn't play last year because of COVID-19. I'm wondering about players being in shape and the type of game we're going to see, because in some instances you're going to have guys who've gone a long time without snapping a football.
Yeah, but we're in the same boat as every other team. And that's been a little bit of the difference with TFC, right? We haven't been in the same boat as other teams. The Argos are, though, so that's, in those areas, it's how can we be more fit than the other teams? How can we be more organized? you do have a new coaching staff, but with this Argos team now, you have a lot of different faces than we had in 2019. And so, you know, John Murphy and Pinball have put together basically a new group that they think can be competitive. And that's the goal. You know, we want to be a competitive team. We want to be a team that can, you know, eventually compete for championships. And I think right now, the goal is to go out and be a playoff team and you know, just be competitive and be a playoff team. And then eventually, you know, try to build that into a championship team. But I would say that's the goal right now is to be a team that can be a playoff team and be a team that can be competitive in every single game it's in.
How, you know, I saw that Randy, that the league office sent out a release about, you know, the discussions with the XFL and, you know, both sides have said that they're tabling those discussions for now. Is how much of a concern did you have that those discussions had become a bit of a side issue, especially in some of the Western markets, right? I mean, it was not necessarily the most popular topic of discussion in places like Winnipeg and Regina, where the, you know, the CFL roots are really deep. Do you think there'll be any long-term damage, especially in some of the Eastern markets, as a result of those discussions?
You know, I don't think so. I think that, you know, we certainly were interested in how the results of those talks would go. But when we found out that there wasn't common ground, you know, I don't think we lost a night of sleep, and we moved on, and we're going to try to focus on this season. I mean, I'm really excited for Pinball. Pinball seems like he's been our GM for a while now, but he is yet to be our GM for a game. And I'm really excited for kind of what he's done now to kind of, you know, he's a real culture guy and a guy that brings such a positive energy. And I'm excited for Ryan Dinwiddie to coach his first game. And so, no, I don't think a negative factor at all for us. I think we're gonna move forward and, you know, we're excited for the team to get back. It's been a long time for these guys, and I've really felt for them that they haven't been able to play and haven't been able, you know, especially the coaches and front office staff, you know, been able to kind of see the results of their work.
Bill, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much. Stay safe. Be well.
Thanks,
and boy, we've got your fingers crossed. I'm so hoping that game is at BMO. Take care, my friend.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Bill Manning, president of Toronto FC and the Toronto Argonauts. So there you go, July 17th. I mean, it does dovetail kind of nicely, doesn't it? The Stage 3 reopening has been moved up to the 16th. TFC plays on the 17th. You heard Bill Manning say that they have had conversations this morning. I'd love to see fans, some level of fan support at these games. My original thinking was just get the boys back, get them on the pitch at home, play. But now I kind of want to see at least some fans in the stands. You know, obviously if it can be done with all protocols followed, but that certainly sounds optimistic. And again, as Bill Manning said, we could have further information on Monday. You can rest assured that the Toronto Blue Jays will be following this with as much interest as anybody. But as Bill said, the approach so far, at least in the part of Toronto FC, has been, hey, we will adhere to health protocols. That means if you're non-vaxxed, you quarantine for 14 days. As he said, if you know, any exemption the government would give us would certainly be welcome. But there is certainly an understanding on the part of Toronto FC that those players, those folks who aren't vaccinated, they may not be able to play right away. It would be interesting to see what happens to a visiting baseball team being told, you know what, that starting pitcher, nope. He can't play. He's going to have to quarantine. There's still some issues, but as I said, we are way, 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 way closer than we were even 2 months ago. So that in and of itself is good news. We know there will be no fans in attendance at the Olympics in Tokyo. Dick Pound is a former Canadian Olympian. He's current member of the COC Board of Directors. He is IOC member as well. Dick Pound joins us next. This is Writer's Block. Have Blue Jays baseball tonight at 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And, of course, on Sportsnet, the Jays will open a three-game series against the Rays. Alec Manoah on the mound for the Jays. Shane McClanahan on the mound for the Rays as the Jays play what I would suggest is one of the biggest series of the year going into the All-Star break. They can. It's a series that can have a dramatic impact on not just the mindset of the Blue Jays in their front office going into the All-Star break, but frankly in the positioning of the team in the standings as well. We are getting closer to the start of the Tokyo Olympics. We had Kylie Moss, Canadian swimmer, on yesterday talking about Canadian swimmers marshaling in Vancouver, getting ready to go over to Tokyo. We saw on social media yesterday pictures of our women's soccer team on their flight to Tokyo. And a lot of dispatches from some of the various track and field events around the world. The track and field competition this year looks like it is going to be smoking hot. There's going to be a lot of great athletic stories at the Tokyo Games. What there won't be, at least as far as we know now, is fans in Tokyo area stadiums and arenas. That was announced a day ago by Japanese Olympic organizers and by the prime minister of the country. This is a result of rising COVID-19 cases and, of course, the highly contagious Delta variant, very much a factor in this as well. I would be lying if I said this comes entirely as a surprise to me. I've just kind of operated under the assumption that the first step towards getting back to normalcy, the first step is getting the athletes on the pitch, on the track, on the field, in the pool, and that we go on from there. I think in North America, we've been a little ahead of the curve there. We've seen it now in Euro, where there are fans in the stands. But my first approach is allow the athletes to compete safely, and if it is a TV event, enjoy it and know that 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road, hopefully things will be back to normal. Dick Pound is a former Canadian Olympian. He's current member of the COC Board of Directors and IOC member, and he joins us on Writer's Block. Dick, thank you for doing this. I trust that you're keeping well and staying safe. I will just ask you, obviously we're disappointed that there will be no spectators, at least in the events in Tokyo. I don't know about some of the satellite events, but at Tokyo at least. Were you surprised by this announcement, though, or in your heart of hearts, did you kind of expect that attendance would either be severely restricted or restricted outright?
Well, it's a funny thing. They've been sort of signaling in the last week or 10 days that, this possibility of no spectators is one that they're looking at seriously. And I think that may have been their way of alerting people to the eventual decision. So it didn't come as a complete surprise. And I think they're being conservative, and that's probably what you should do in the face of a pandemic. But it'll be disappointing to some people, for sure. Mm-hmm. Although, when you think of it, 99.5% or more of the people around the world that will experience the Tokyo Games will do so by television or some other electronic platform, those platforms don't care whether there are live spectators in the stadium. So, it's spectators are certainly nice to have and preferable to have, but they're not must-haves.
There are going to be people out there, and I'm certainly not a naysayer when it comes to the Olympic movement, but you know as well as I do. I mean, there are always people who are going to be criticizing the Olympics for something, but there are people that are going to be saying, okay, no fans in the stands. Why are we doing this? What would your response be to them?
Well, I guess it would be, look, if you add up all the tickets that would be available to fill the stands, you might get to a number like 8 million. Mm-hmm. But we're aiming at an audience that's going to be something in the order of 5 billion.
Right.
So it's kind of a rounding error in some respects. It'll cost the Tokyo organizers probably, $800 million or something like that, which is not walking around money, but I think their preference is to be safe rather than sorry.
Well, look, understanding nobody can necessarily plan for a pandemic, although from this point on, I would think people will probably, somebody in some meeting will at least raise their hand and say, what if? And I'm not just talking about the Olympics, I'm talking about everything. Are there any lessons for the Olympic movement out of this, or any, any additional protocols we'll see in future Olympics as a result of what we've seen with COVID-19?
Well, I wouldn't think they'd be specifically Olympic. As you mentioned, there are lots of other large gatherings I think some of the questions that really need to be asked is what happened to the warning system? You know, why were all of these things dismantled, including here in Canada, when it's absolutely critical if something like this is building up that you're able to swing into action right away rather than, a month later or 3 months later, whatever it may be. And what can we do in the future to be alert to those possibilities? But in terms of Olympics specifically, no, I think, we would be riding along on the wave with the population or the other institutions at large.
I wonder if maybe, it's like there are a lot of sports where the best advertising vehicle for the sport are the athletes, the games themselves. And I'm wondering if one of your hopes is that, okay, we now know that there will be no spectators in the stands. We've all had those internal debates we have about holding a large sports event during a pandemic or at the end of a pandemic. We've gone through it in the States. We've gone through it in Canada. Now let's turn it over to the athletes. Is it your hope that the show, and I'm using that in air quotes, that the athletes put on will... I think we had you on a little early, and we were talking about how the Olympics could be a celebration of how we've come out of this, how we've persevered. Can the athletes put on a show in empty stadiums, and can we still have that effect as a result of that? That we have persevered.
I think we can. I think the athletes will do making the impossible look easy. It'll be the shock and awe that it usually is. And I think that will take over once the games start. There's always uncertainty as you lead up to things. And are they going to get everything right? And if you've been to Olympics, you tend to have the first couple of days, the traffic, the transportation system doesn't work and so on. But
right.
Everyone sorts that out and the focus changes from, informed or uninformed comment to this is the real thing. This is what it's all about. And a lot of these doubts recede very quickly. And by the end of it, I think even the doubters in Japan will say, actually that wasn't too bad at all. We're glad that those in authority insisted that we go ahead because it didn't turn out to be a super spreader and it did turn out to be just a fantastic celebration. And maybe that's the kind of good news the world needs at the end of the last 15 or 16 months of constant worry.
Did we ever come close to these games being being canceled outright?
Well, I think early on, in sort of back in March of 2020, when it sort of became clear that, you know, it's just not going to work in calendar 2020, and your options tend to be go or no go, and we sort of allowed the Japanese to think about it for a while and come up with the idea of postponement, which is a great thing. So we say, look, that's a great idea. How long can you hold this, you know, together?
Right.
If it's postponed, and they said, well, not longer than a year, for sure.
Right.
And then they looked at, you know, do you have it at a different time of year? And they say, well, you know, we picked this time of year because, you know, everyone's out of school and people are on holidays, and to the extent that you get any kind of a break from the size of a city like Tokyo, this is the best time to do it. It's not super weather, but all the other aspects are there. So let's, you know, our recommendation would be that we do it exactly the same time in 2021, and the IOC said, okay, we'll help. We'll make sure that the international sports calendars of all of these Olympic sports are readjusted to enable the games to go ahead. I mean, even world championships have had to be rescheduled. And anyway, we can do all that as part of our contribution to the effort.
What difference can, I mean, the two events that, you know, a lot of folks watch, set their calendars by, are the opening and closing ceremonies. And that goes for sports fans or non-sports fans. I mean, everybody I know watches them, essentially. How different will they be without fans in the stands? And has, I guess, has the Tokyo committee had enough time to sort of think about, you know, if they have to redo something? Because these events tend to always, there's always a certain element of fan involvement or of in-stadium involvement. Have they had to change a lot, or has there been enough lead-in time that, you know, we will see a show for the opening and closing ceremonies?
I think there'll be some kind of a show. I must say, I have not seen any of the scenarios that probably exist. Mm-hmm. I'd say the opening ceremony is a little more of a set piece in the sense that the teams are all organized and they come in behind their flags and all that sort of stuff. The closing ceremonies, as you know, in recent years have tended to be a kind of a large street party. Mm-hmm. On the field of play, and I think that probably is going to have to be adjusted, but I'm not quite sure how they'll do it, and I'm sure that some portion of the show will be entertainment, and maybe even that will have to be not be on the field of play, but you know, transported in from somewhere else. So It'll be fun to see how they adjust, but they're a very, very, very capable society, and they understand the importance of the symbolism as well as the event. So I knowing what we know about their difficulties, I think we'll probably be very pleased to see what the outcome is.
Dick, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much. Safe travels. And I think, as you said, once the games start and it's turned over to the athletes, I'm sure the show will be terrific. Thanks so much for doing this.
Fingers crossed. Thanks. Nice to be on the show. Bye.
Take care. That's Dick Pound, former Canadian Olympian, current member of the COC Board of Directors, an IOC member. And, the Olympics are starting on July, what is it, the 25th, 23rd? Two weeks? Can it really be 2 weeks? And I think in the last 10 days or so, I've started to started to pay a little more attention to the track and field. We had Anson Henry on talking about that, and I kind of do. That's generally how my Olympic warm-up begins. I start paying attention to the lead-in track and field events, and to of course we had the Canadian men's the basketball team, the Olympic qualifying and all that, but for me it's kind of that last Diamond League meet, the last exhibition meet before the Olympics, and you sort of try to figure out who the new up and coming sprint star is and things of that nature. And then it just, it kind of builds. It kind of builds from there. But look, we've gotten, you know, we spent a year watching sports with no fans in the stands, right? Remember when the Bundesliga, the first major league to come back, came back with no fans in the stands. We kind of got used to that. It was fun. It was just, and then the Premier League, and then we had the NHL and the NBA in bubbles, and we were just so thrilled to have sports back that the fans in the stands, you know, it's not that it didn't matter, but we loved having our athletes back, and we didn't even need the can noise. I mean, I was always listening to the soccer telecast that had the natural sound. I didn't care about the fan noise. But now we've started to get fans back into games, right? We saw it in baseball. We saw it in football, college sports. We're seeing it in basketball in some venues. We're seeing it in baseball now. My goodness, it seems that baseball is just, in terms of fans in the stands, is back to where it used to be. And Sunday, we're going to see 80,000 fans in Wembley for the Euro final. And then the Olympics are going to come in, and we're going to be back to empty stadiums. And I can tell you from covering Olympics that the role fans play in creating the environment is much more than you'd think. That moment in the 100 meters where a noisy, raucous crowd silences as one for the starter's pistol, and then the immediate rush of emotion that comes when the sprinters leave the block. That is of all the sort of sensory things I have been able to experience as a sports writer and a sports fan, nothing compares to that, that quiet and that sense of anticipation. That's, you know, it's going to be lost. I'm hoping in some ways that we don't, that the folks, the Olympic broadcasters, go easy on the piped in crowd noise, because it's not going to be the same. It's not going to be the same. We will take a break and come back, get you set for Tim and Friends. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, well, so much for Solo. I will be joined next week by Richard Deitch. Regular service will be resumed. We have Richard Deitch alongside me in Writer's Block from 3 to 5 Eastern, and then Mr. Brunt will be back the week after. He's set himself up in Newfoundland and gone through all his protocols and chopped the wood and checked the bear trap and gone out fishing and done the usual stuff he has to do to prepare for his summer in Newfoundland. And so it'll be Deitch next week, Brunt the week after. And as always, Baseball Central with Kevin Barker from 2 to 3. This being a Friday, Kenny the Jet Smith will make his regular appearance on Tim and Friends to discuss the NBA Finals. The Phoenix Suns up 2-0. Ariel Helwani will be around to discuss the big UFC card. Ben Wagner, we'll talk about the Jays going into the All-Star break. First of 3 games tonight between the Jays and the Rays. 7 o'clock right here on Sportsnet 590. The Fan at Sportsnet. Christopher Clary as well joining Tim and Friends as they will get you set for the weekend of sports ahead. And a reminder, our conversation earlier today with Bill Manning, president of Toronto FC. I think a little bit of insight there. If you're a Toronto sports fan, July 17th is Toronto FC's next game. It is at BMO Field. It is the day after we moved to step 3 in this province. It sure sounds like, fingers crossed, knock on wood, et cetera, et cetera, it sure sounds like Toronto FC will be playing at home at BMO Field And nothing yet on fans. I want to cross that bridge when we come to it. But it certainly feels as if TFC and the Blue Jays are going to be home at some point this summer. I'm still exercising a bit of caution when it comes to the Blue Jays being here at the end of July. I think there may be a little bit of lifting that needs to be done before we get to that. But fingers crossed. Want to thank Derek and Danielle for helping me out, getting the guests, turning the knobs.